Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. This is Will Aitchison, and I'll be with you for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so while we talk about recent developments in the public safety workplace. I do have several cases that I wanted to talk to you about. As I've mentioned in these First Thursday podcasts, courts keep marching on, albeit at a much slower pace than they used to. So we're still getting some cases of distinction involving the public safety employment setting. And in particular, we have a pretty important Brady case that I'm going to talk about today. But first, I wanted to talk to you about the labor and employment issues coming out of the pandemic and also the police reform movement. Let's start with the pandemic. What's going on in the labor and employment world in public safety with respect to the pandemic? And the answer to that one is pretty easy. Not a whole lot. People, to begin with, don't seem to be bargaining contracts at all. It's almost impossible to bargain a contract by Zoom, even though some people are doing it. We try to gather through a variety of search engine tools, contract settlements from around the country. And this time of year in June, when we have the July 1 fiscal year that most cities and counties are under around the country coming up very shortly, this time of year, we'd be seeing, four, five, six contract settlements a day from various states around the country. We are now at the point where we're seeing maybe two or three contract settlements a month. What's going on is people just simply aren't talking. They even aren't talking about extending contracts. There's just not a lot of negotiations that is happening. And I think it's pretty easy to predict that with the exception of the most simple of negotiations, where there's an agreement to extend a contract for a year, perhaps with a wage increase, perhaps not with a wage increase. Except for those sorts of negotiations, we're not going to see much in the way of collective bargaining for a long period of time. On the employment setting, when we're looking at things like the FMLA and the ADA and COVID-19, we're starting to see some litigation being filed around the country, but nothing to the level where we're getting court decisions. So far, most of the litigation seems to center around the Americans with Disabilities Act. To what extent does an employer have to reasonably accommodate an employee's COVID-19 status, or even a little bit more complicated, if the employee has some other type of physical condition that makes it inadvisable for them to work in a crowded workplace, for example, if their immune system is compromised, what sort of reasonable accommodations does the employer have to make? And we're also seeing some medical privacy cases that are being filed where employers want to know more about the employee's physical condition than the employee feels comfortable providing. We're keeping an eye out for all of that litigation, and I will keep you posted on it once we start to see our first decisions. I would expect to see them by the time of our August 1st Thursday. Now let's talk the police reform movement. What are we seeing there? Just today, when I'm recording this on a Monday because we have sort of an altered work schedule in LRIS thanks to the pandemic. We saw today the Police Executive Research Forum drop what it calls a critical issues report. What they do, apparently, or at least what they did for this one, PERF, by the way, think of it as kind of a foundation that is really focused on the interests of police executives, usually in large metropolitan jurisdictions. I know that's a slightly inaccurate capturing of PERF, but that's the way I think of it, and actually I think that's pretty appropriate. So what was their critical issues forum? What was that all about? Well, they gathered together several, not a lot of them, just a handful, police chiefs and retired police chiefs, and they asked them this burning question. What do you think about binding arbitration? And guess what? Police chiefs didn't like binding arbitration. And you know why they didn't like binding arbitration? Because their disciplinary decisions were subject to reversal. Let me let that sink in for just a moment. Instead, what at least one of the chiefs who was in this forum suggested is, you know what? We ought to have the final decision as to discipline. We, meaning either us, the police chiefs, or maybe there should be a review with a city manager or a mayor. Okay, I'll let you catch your breath while you recover from that stunning news that police chiefs object to binding arbitration. But that causes me to tell you a little bit of a story. A story about what I think of as a close encounter of the third kind with the media. And it was about binding arbitration. So I got a call from a reporter, well, I want to say 10 days ago, 14 days ago, a reporter from the Wall Street Journal who was going to do an article about binding arbitration. Now, I was nervous about taking his phone call. The Wall Street Journal has made it very clear they do not believe police unions should exist. And if they do exist, they think that they should not be able to negotiate anything other than wages or perhaps benefits. The Wall Street Journal, which is owned by the Murdoch family, takes a fairly predictable Murdoch-affiliated line on public sector unions. And in particular, they don't seem to like police unions. So I was kind of nervous about the whole thing going through the interview. But he seemed very pleasant, the reporter did. And we had a nice conversation that lasted about 45 minutes. He wanted to know about the history of binding arbitration and how employers do in binding arbitration. He was going to focus on Minneapolis, of course. And he was seemed to be fairly concerned. Big issue for him was, how often is it that employers lose in binding arbitration? Because he was hearing stories that employers always lose, or mostly lose. Or from Minneapolis, he actually heard from a reform advocate that the who had read all the binding arbitration disciplinary decisions in Minneapolis for many years, he actually heard from him that the employer lost 50% of the time. So I took him through what the facts are with respect to binding arbitration. And in fact, that Minneapolis police activist had it right. When you look at police disciplinary cases, and when you do so on a national level, you find that employers win about 50% of disciplinary arbitrations. Unions flat out win about 15, 20% of them. And the others are split decisions where the employer's disciplinary sanction is reduced, but the employee still gets disciplined. I then told the reporter, but that's not the whole story about binding arbitration, because not all disciplinary cases are appealed to arbitration. Only unions typically can make the decision as to whether or not a case goes to arbitration, and unions are very judicious about making that decision. Just like any other organizational entity contemplating litigation, unions take a look at things like the chances of success. Well, you know, what's the likelihood we're going to win here? How much is this thing going to cost going to arbitration? Things like, is there a possibility if we go to arbitration that we will set adverse precedent that will impact everybody in the bargaining unit? Unions will consider what other arbitrators have said about the same issue. There's just a wide range of factors that unions, or for that matter, companies, businesses, consider in deciding whether or not to go to arbitration. And I gave the reporter an estimate based upon my personal experience representing police unions, but also what I've been told by presidents and board members of police unions over the decades that I've been doing this work. I gave them the estimate that less than 1% of disciplinary decisions made by an employer are actually appealed to binding arbitration. I think, based on my personal experience, the number's even smaller. I think it's about 0.5% of disciplinary decisions. And I gave them an example of a large union, well, large mid-sized union that I had represented for 35 years, where the employer made at least 50 disciplinary decisions a year. Everything from oral reprimands to written reprimands, up to and including terminations. And over the 35 years, that meant that this employer, if you do the math, had made over 2,000 disciplinary decisions. And I told him, and this was actually reported in a local Portland paper, so I gave him the source for that. I told him that in my 35 years, I had arbitrated 8 cases for that union. And that came out to less than 0.5%. And I said, so, look, when you're considering binding arbitration, understand that the unions are a huge check on what gets to arbitration. And the result is that in over 99% of the occasions where a law enforcement employer disciplines an employee, the employer's discipline stands. It's upheld. It's less than 1% of the cases where an arbitrator finds that the employer made a mistake in disciplining employees. And I mentioned, if you're a union, you don't want to take bad cases to arbitration. You only want to take cases to arbitration where you're pretty darn sure you're going to win, because you don't want to spend a lot of money on a losing cause, or because the employer got it right, whatever the rationale may be. And so I concluded by telling him, arbitration simply isn't the issue you are hearing people complaining about when they talk about police chiefs' disciplinary decisions being overturned. Arbitration isn't the cause of that. Arbitration is a safety valve for those cases where the employer got it wrong. And all public employees, including police officers, need the potential for access to that safety valve. Well, fast forward to a couple of days ago when the article was finally printed. Guess what? No mention of anything I said in the article about how often cases get to arbitration. No mention of me. I don't really care about that. I wanted to get the message out rather than see my name in the Wall Street Journal, where that might actually cause me some problems in some circles. Instead, what the article focused on was how bad arbitration is in terms of imposing discipline in a police department. Really, come on. One of the big problems we have right now with the massive public discussion about policing is people are not talking about facts. We've got to start having fact-based conversations. For that matter, we've got to start having conversations. Nobody's really having conversations right now. But when we do have them, they have to be based on reality. They can't be discussions that are bumper sticker or protest signs or graffiti discussions. We have to have a conversation, and we have to have a shared understanding of reality for that conversation to produce positive results. And shame on the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if it was that reporter or his editor that cut that stuff out. Shame on the reporter or the editor for creating an entirely false picture of the binding arbitration process, a picture created for the political ends, I believe, of the Wall Street Journal. Okay, I'm through complaining. Let's go to the cases. And I want to start with this Brady case. By the way, I think this case is important enough that we are going to interview the lawyers who represented the union in this case. That'll be part of our premium podcast series. I anticipate we will have that interview available either in late July or August. And we get two for the price of one. We get two lawyers who were involved in the case, one of whom tried the case and eventually argued it before the appeals court in Pennsylvania that decided this. It's really an interesting case. So it comes out of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where the police officers there are represented by the Teamsters Union, Local 776 of the Teamsters Union. The collective bargaining agreement has the traditional just cause provision in it, and it also has a clause that I'll talk about a little bit later that incorporates the Supreme Court's Loudermill decision into the contract. Just as a reminder, in the Supreme Court's Loudermill decision, the court said that before a public employer may affect the property right of an employee, that it must give the employee procedural due process, notice of why it intends to affect the property right, and the opportunity for a what's called deprivation hearing. And typically what that means is whenever a public employee who has tenure on the job has some guarantee of protection from discharge at the will of the employer, whenever you have an employee who has some appeal rights to discipline, the employer has to do a pre-disciplinary hearing. And those have become known as Loudermill hearings. So you'll hear me talking a little bit about the Loudermill clause in the Gettysburg contract. So what is this case all about? Well, the borough of Gettysburg decides that one of its officers has potentially committed criminal misconduct. And so they refer to the local district attorney a criminal investigation into this officer. He's only referred to in the court's opinion, by the way, as grievant. So we don't really know what his name is. The DA begins an investigation. And before the investigation is concluded, the DA sends a letter to the police chief. And the police chief, the borough, had actually been asking the DA for a letter. And here's what the letter says in relevant part. As you are aware, the department referred a criminal investigation involving this officer to my office, and we have proceeded accordingly. As a result of that investigation, while not complete, it is the position of this office that it will not participate in any future cases which are based solely upon the uncorroborated observations and testimony of the officer. Please do not disseminate this letter or the information contained therein to any other non-law enforcement entity. I cannot stress this enough. Dissemination would result in this office potentially failing to interact with the department as a whole going forward. Whoa! How many things are wrong with that letter from the DA? Let's see if we can count them. Number one, the letter is being sent before the investigation is complete. So before the district attorney knows all of the facts, before the employee, the officer, has been given any sort of opportunity to respond to any of the conclusions that the district attorney has reached, the district attorney is sending a letter clearly with the intention of terminating the officer's career as a police officer. Secondly, the DA doesn't have the guts to stand by the letter. the DA is saying, okay, we're sending you this letter, but keep it secret. And if you don't keep it secret, we're going to stop dealing with the department as a whole, or as it's put in the letter, will result in this office potentially failing to interact with the department as a whole. Third, and I'm not going to go over the specific words, but someone in the DA's office there in Gettysburg needs to be introduced to a style manual for grammar. That letter's horribly written. Okay, that aside. So the borough gets this letter, and the implications in the court's opinion are that the borough wanted that letter, wanted something saying that, and it immediately begins disciplinary proceedings against the officer, and it schedules a Loudermill hearing, this pre-disciplinary hearing. At the hearing, the officer is told about the generalities of the DA's letter. It's told, you know, what the contents of the letter are, but the letter isn't produced, and there is no information given the officer as to why the letter was sent, as to what the underlying allegations were against the officer, the underlying allegations that may give rise to criminal liability and certainly disciplinary sanctions. The officer doesn't have any way of responding in the Loudermill hearing other than to say, you need to tell me why I'm being disciplined, and the borough concludes the hearing and fires the officer. The officer's labor organization, Local 776 of the Teamsters, challenges the decision in arbitration. An arbitrator finds that the borough did not have just cause to terminate the officer and orders that he be made whole for all lost wages and benefits. And then the borough files an appeal in Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court. Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court is the intermediate court of appeals in the Pennsylvania court system. And what the borough is saying, it makes several arguments. The first one it makes is that the arbitrator's award exceeded the arbitrator's jurisdiction because it forced the borough to employ an officer who could no longer fulfill all required job duties. And the court disagrees and said, look, I'm quoting, the arbitrator did not find that the grievant committed misconduct and place restrictions on the grievant as a result thereof. Rather, the arbitrator said, I am unable to address the substantive merits of the borough's termination decision in this case, since I find that the borough failed to provide the grievant with adequate due process prior to terminating his employment. Now, what the court ends up concluding is, look, the arbitrator found that since the officer wasn't given any basis for his discharge and had no opportunity to defend himself at the Loudermill hearing, the borough didn't have just cause to fire him. And that clearly is within the arbitrator's powers to decide whether or not just cause existed for discipline. The borough next argues that the arbitrator didn't have any jurisdiction to address the officer's Loudermill claim, that he was deprived of due process by the way the borough went about the Loudermill hearing. And, you know, kind of in the abstract, that's not a bad argument, right? Because arbitrators can only construe and apply the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. Loudermill is a due process notion, constitutional due process notion under the 14th Amendment. And there are arbitration decisions saying, where arbitrators say, we're not going to consider constitutional issues. That's not our job. But here, the court says, employer, you incorporated into the contract Loudermill guarantees. How'd you do that? Here's the language. A non-probationary officer shall receive a due process proceeding of the type required by Loudermill. The court tells the borough all the arbitrator was doing was construing the contract. If you want to incorporate constitutional principles into your collective bargaining agreements and make them binding on you, you can. But then it is within the authority of an arbitrator to address those issues. The borough's not through yet. The borough next argues that it was denied due process. How was it denied due process? Because the arbitrator ruled against the borough for failing to do something that it was legally impossible for it to do. And what is it that it was legally impossible to do? Give the officer an answer as to why it was he was being fired. So the borough is telling the court, look, the prosecutor's not telling us why he thinks that this officer is a problematic officer. We don't have that information. We can't, so therefore we can't give the information to the officer. So it deprives us of our due process rights by forcing us or telling us that we were obligated to do something that we legally cannot do. The court, first of all, understands that argument, which is kind of one step above me. No offense, but I really do find some serious problems with the employer's and the prosecutor's decisions in this case. And here's what the court says. Quote, the borough chose to discharge grievant due to a letter for which the underlying basis was unknown. Thus, the borough put itself in a situation where it could not provide the required information, not the arbitrator. Borough's last argument is, hey, this decision by the arbitrator, it violates public policy. We can't have arbitrators reinstating employees, police officers, who can't testify. And the court makes very short work of that argument because almost alone among states, Pennsylvania has not adopted the public policy exception to the finality of arbitration awards. And in some states, a court will not enforce an arbitrator's award if it violates a clearly articulated and dominant public policy. But Pennsylvania doesn't buy that argument. And in the words of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in another case, and I'm going to quote, broadening the narrow scope of review to allow courts to interfere with an arbitrator's decision when that award could be deemed to be violative of public policy, however that nebulous concept may be defined, would expand the scope of review in arbitration cases beyond that with which we are comfortable. So the court upholds the arbitrator's opinion. The officer is going to end up being reinstated, and the borough and the district attorney are going to have to figure out how to deal with the officer. Now, we're going to take that case apart in the premium podcast series that I mentioned earlier. We're going to take it apart with the lawyers who were involved in it. And I think you're really going to enjoy it because it's going to give you sort of a bird's eye look at the strategies and tactics that are brought to disciplinary cases by litigants in these cases. It's going to be from the unions. Perspective, but I hope to do one from the employer's perspective shortly. Next up, a federal court of appeals decision that addresses the question, when can an employer tear up the provisions of a collective bargaining agreement that call for a wage increase? And the answer that the court gives is, under some rare occasions, that is permissible. All right, let's talk about the case. It involves Nassau County, New York. Nassau County has been in the throes of fiscal emergencies for years and years and years. They started, I think, in the problem areas about 20 years ago. Eventually, the New York legislature passes what's known as the Nassau County Interim Finance Authority Act, or NIFA, as it's sometimes called, or the NIFA Act. And what it did was to create a governmental agency, a separate governmental agency that was an instrumentality of the state that had the ability to oversee the county's finances. So in some states, these things are called control boards or emergency boards. They have different names in different states. But basically, you've got somebody other than the county with the authority to intervene in the county's finances. Intervene how? Among the powers that this act gave NEPA was the power to impose a control period when NEPA makes the determination as to whether or not the county is suffering from a serious deficit in its operating funds. What happens during the control period? NEPA gets this authority, gets all sorts of power. And that power includes the ability to approve or disapprove of a contract or other obligation and the power to freeze employee wages. So all that happens in the early part of the millennium. Years later, the county reaches agreements with a bunch of unions, including the four law enforcement unions with which it negotiates. And those agreements call for wage increases in 2011. However, in 2010, the county's finances are back in an unhealthy state. Early 2011, NEPA intervenes and imposes a wage freeze for 2011, despite the requirements of the labor contracts. The four police unions sue, and they alleged that the wage freeze violated the contracts clause of the United States Constitution. What's the contracts clause? This is one I can pretty much guarantee you when you go through law school, even if you are taking constitutional law, you will come out of law school without a clue as to what the contracts clause is. It's kind of an obscure section of the Constitution. If you're counting, it's in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, and the entirety of it reads this way: no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. 11 words. Well, I tell you, our founding fathers knew how to be succinct. When you take a look at the fact that the First Amendment, for example, is one sentence, and here we have a contracts clause that is 11 words. So what the unions are arguing here is the state, by passing the NEPA Act, impaired the obligation of contracts by giving to NEPA, the authority itself, the ability to basically tear up the wage increase section of the collective bargaining agreement as it controlled the wages for 2011. So what does the Federal Court of Appeals say about this case? And this is the Federal Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which remains one of the best federal courts of appeals in the country in terms of, I think, intelligent decisions, kind of without regard to the results in a particular case. So what does the court say? The court says, look, it's clear that either the NEPA Act itself or NEPA's decision under the Act to impose a wage freeze implicates the contracts clause. But which of the two was it that actually implicates the contracts clause? Is it the act that was passed way back 20 years ago? Or is it NEPA's decision to invalidate the 2011 wage increase? And the court ends up saying, we're just going to assume that it's the wage freeze that implicates the contracts clause. We're not going to actually have to decide that issue because, frankly, the unions lose under either construct. So what does the court say about the contracts clause? It says, look, there are two different mandates, two different imperatives to the contract clause. The first is that the government, like private parties, is bound by its contract. and can't use its governmental powers to impair those contracts materially. The second imperative of the Contracts Clause is that a state or a local governmental body may not contract away its power to govern in the public interest. And it's that latter test that the court ends up getting concerned with. And the court says, we are not going to find a violation of the Contracts Clause if three requirements are met. Number one, is the contractual impairment substantial? Two, does the law serve a legitimate public purpose, such as remedying a general social or economic problem? And three, if that purpose is actually demonstrated, is the means chosen by the government to accomplish the purpose reasonable and necessary? And the court ends up saying, we think the wage freeze was reasonable and necessary. The county faced a budget shortfall of $176 million. The NEPA threshold, when NEPA was given the authority to act, was only $27 million. So therefore, the NEPA is responding to what the court refers to as a genuine crisis. The court also says, look, we think the wage freeze was very reasonable. NEPA is an independent body. It's not the county freezing its own wages. NEPA is an independent body. And the alternative proposals that the unions suggest, raising taxes, raising fines or fees, those were under the county's power. They were not in NEPA's control. So from this perspective, the wage freeze was clearly reasonable. No violation of the Contracts Clause. Case dismissed. I want to last talk about two cases that discuss something I have never talked about in these podcasts, and that is the issue of severance. It comes up from time to time, and severance is where a labor board intervenes and cuts a bargaining unit into pieces. Sometimes you see this in law enforcement where you have lieutenants who want to get their own union together, or sergeants who want to get their own union together. They don't want to be in a broader union. In the fire service, you have seen this with battalion chiefs who want to form their own labor organizations. And these two cases describe the principles that labor boards will bring into play when they're looking at these severance cases. And they come up often enough that I think it's important to stress what these principles are and why it is very difficult for a group of disgruntled sergeants or battalion chiefs, or in one of these cases, detectives, a group of people who are disgruntled with their union representation, why it's so difficult for them to get out and form their own organization. So I'm going to start with a New Jersey case. This involves a petition that was filed with New Jersey's Public Employment Relations Commission, PERC. And the petition was filed by something known as the Middlesex Sheriff's Sergeants Association, which is FOP Lodge 59. I'll call it the FOP, just to make it very easy. And they file a petition seeking to sever sergeants from the bargaining unit represented by the Middlesex County Sheriff's Superior Officers Association, which is local 165A of the Police Benevolent Association. I'll call that the PBA. So what you have, you have a supervisory bargaining unit, one that is comprised of sergeants and above, and they are represented by the PBA, and the FOP wants to get the sergeants out of them. The PBA had represented the sergeants since at least 1977, and there's a charming part in PERC's opinion where it indicates that nobody has any clue what happened prior to 1977. You got to keep records, by the way. But at any rate, no one had a clue. So when the FOP files this petition, the PBA intervenes in the proceedings, and the whole thing ends up in the lap of what's known as the representation director of PERC. What's a representation director? In a lot of labor boards, particularly larger ones, you have this position. It's called different things, but mostly it's called representation director, where you have one person in charge of how bargaining units are put together, how they're constructed, and whether or not people should be added to them or subtracted from them and all that sort of stuff. And cases go to that person to begin with, and then there is a full appeal that goes typically to the labor board. I'm going to be talking about the representation director's decision in this case. And the representation director starts a very lengthy opinion, and it's a very well-written opinion, I commend it to you, with a summary of how bargaining units are constructed. And in the process, the representation director gives us these basic principles. Principle number one, we like big bargaining units. We like, as it's referred to in this decision, broad-based units. Why? Because we don't like the fragmentation of employees into a whole lot of different small unions. That's simply inefficient, and it's pretty terrible for an employer to have to negotiate with four or five or six different unions for the same department, much less all of the departments that it represents. The way the representation director puts it is, I'm quoting, the reasoning for this is based on the policy considerations of the Collective Bargaining Act for stability and harmony that would be jeopardized by a multiplicity of units caused by fragmentation and the likelihood of attendant problems of competing demands, whipsawing, and continuous negotiations. So that's principle number one. We like big units. Principle number two, we are not going to get involved in one of these disputes as to whether people should be in this bargaining unit or that one, unless there's a dispute. If you guys, employer and union, if you're happy, we're happy. Don't bring your cases to us. Now, you can agree to move positions around from one bargaining unit to another, and we will probably rubber stamp that. But the only time typically we're going to get involved is a case like this. If you've got a third-party petitioner here, the FOP, who wants to grab some but not all of employees in an existing bargaining unit. Okay. Principle number three. It's very important to us whether or not there is what's known as a community of interest. And there's a lot of factors that go into whether or not employees have a community of interest. Do they work in the same department? In this case, of course, they do. Do they have jobs that are somewhat similar in nature? Do they work around each other? There's a lot of different factors that go into a community of interest. And so that's our third criterion, is we're going to look into whether or not that community of interest exists. Fourth, if a community of interest exists in the unit that someone wants to carve out, in this case, the sergeants, we're not going to take them out, even if there's that community of interest, unless the party that wants to get them out shows that the bargaining relationship is unstable or that the incumbent organization, here the PBA, hasn't provided responsible representation. And even if all those tests are met, even if there's a community of interest, even if there's an unstable relationship or whatever it might be, we are going to consider whether or not there is a conflict of interest. So we're going to look at whether or not keeping these employees in their existing bargaining unit poses a conflict of interest among the members of the bargaining unit. In this case, says the representation director, comes down to the last of those criteria. Because what the FOP is saying is there's a substantial conflict of interest, and the substantial conflict of interest is that lieutenants and captains, the other members of the existing PBA bargaining unit, get involved in the discipline of sergeants. So how does the representation director deal with that issue? He says, look, you just, FOP, you didn't establish a substantial conflict of interest warranting severance here. You didn't meet your burden of proof. You only brought forth two incidents showing the investigation of sheriff's sergeants. In one, a superior officer reported misconduct on the part of a sheriff's sergeant for feigning sickness, but it was the sheriff in that case who initiated the disciplinary process by calling on internal affairs to investigate it. It wasn't the superior, lower-ranking superior officer who did. And in the second case that the FOP raises, the representation director says, a sheriff's captain met with a lieutenant and a sergeant after they had filed complaints against each other, and the sheriff's captain was trying to figure out what was going on. And all he did was to report the incident to the sheriff, and the sheriff made the decision, we don't need to investigate this from a disciplinary standpoint. Thus, the hearing or the representation director concludes, and I'm quoting, the record shows that sheriff's captains and sheriff's lieutenants have no formal role in the disciplinary process itself, and decisions to initiate the process and conduct formal investigations are made by the sheriff. No potential conflict of interest. Petition to sever the sergeants denied. And so the representation director is saying the sergeants in Middlesex County are going to stay with the PBA and not the FOP. Now, that's very similar to the second case that I want to talk to you about. And this comes from Florida and involves the St. Petersburg Police Officers Association. By the way, just as an aside, you don't see these sorts of battles very much in the fire service because everybody is represented by the IAFF, and it just doesn't work to have one arm of the IAFF seeking to carve employees out of another arm of the IAFF. In fact, it's not even allowed under the IAFF's constitution. So you just don't see these things in the fire service. And mostly you don't see them in police. The exception is Florida. Florida, for as long as I have been in this business, has been a hotbed of conflict as to who is going to represent who. And for the longest time, the conflict was between a PBA, statewide PBA down in Florida, and the FOP. And I'd sit watching on the sidelines as the FOP and the PBA would fight over this group of employees or that group of employees. And then maybe 5 years later, whoever lost that fight would come back and try again, and maybe they'd win that time. And then after many years of this, you then saw the Teamsters move in and try to take away bargaining units from both of them. And then more recently, you've had IUPA, the International Union of Police Associations, come in and put its oar in the water and try to take bargaining units from all three of them. So you see a lot of these sorts of cases come out of Florida for some reason. It's so clear if you are an observer from 3,000 miles away, the way I am, that Florida police would be a lot better if there was one statewide organization rather than now four. And if they did not expend their time and effort and money fighting with each other over who's going to represent who, but nobody asked me to get involved in that. So never mind. All right, so what's this one about? This involves the St. Petersburg POA that files a petition to carve police detectives out of a bargaining unit that involved rank-and-file police officers. So the bargaining unit included police officers, forensic service technicians, latent print examiners, and detectives. So it's a rank-and-file unit. Doesn't involve sergeants or anybody like that. And the detectives want out. The detectives and this four classification bargaining unit were represented by the Suncoast Police Benevolent Association. So we have this complicated situation where the POA is trying to get the detectives away from the PBA. And Florida's Public Employment Relations Commission says no. And listen to some of the principles that PERC enunciates. They'll sound familiar because I covered them about 5 minutes ago when I was talking about the New Jersey case. PERC says, we're not going to sever classifications from a bargaining unit unless the party that seeks severance demonstrates that the existing unit is unworkable or otherwise inappropriate. This is, says PERC, a significant burden. And what are we supposed to consider? We're supposed to consider, and I'm quoting, the history of employee relations within the organization of the public employer and the interests of the employees in the continuation of a traditional, workable, and accepted negotiations relationship. There's a bias towards history in these cases. And the party seeking to sever classifications out of a bargaining unit has a tough burden of overcoming that bias towards history. Well, here, the case was very easy for PERC because the POA, the one that wanted to get the detectives out, actually didn't call any witnesses. All it did was to introduce 32 exhibits. Someone's going to have to tell me how you can introduce exhibits without calling any witnesses to authenticate the exhibits. But nonetheless, that's what happened here. And the 32 exhibits involve situations where specialized internal affairs officers routinely took part in investigations of bargaining unit members. And these would be detectives. Florida's PERC says, look, all that was demonstrated here was that it's very rare that a detective might be involved in the investigation of a bargaining unit member. We're not going to rely on rumor. We're not going to rely on stories from many, many years ago. What we need is evidence that, and I'm quoting, the detectives are not being heard by the PBA because they make up a smaller portion of the overall unit. There's no evidence of that here. All right. Now, I want to wrap up by describing for you one more podcast that we're going to do, premium podcast. You recall that about a month ago or so, I did a podcast about 10 points that I think that police unions have to follow in the future if they're going to be successful in this time where police unions are, in some states, and I'm not exaggerating, facing an existential challenge. They're facing a challenge as to their very existence. I got a lot of really favorable comments from people about those 10 points. Nobody is yet said anything negative about it, which I find really, really heartening. The special podcast that we're going to do, the premium podcast we're going to do, will involve two union presidents, one from Yonkers, New York, one from Anchorage, Alaska. They're going to go over those 10 points and what they think about them and what the history of their organizations are and how they are faring in this mood of very, very loud voices seeking reform of the police union movement. I think you're going to find that podcast very interesting. So with that, I want to thank you for joining me for our regular First Thursday podcast. Hope to see you in August. I sure hope things have calmed down by August. And I sure hope we have the pandemic more under control than we do right now. So stay safe and stay well. This is Will Aitchison signing off.